Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Shout out Dunkers once again for embracing your bounce. Nikias, how we doing, man? Looking great. The view looks outstanding. I don't know if you got the Julius Suite or the Nobu Suite, but hey, 56th floor looks great. Per usual, really happy for you coming off, you know, second row at the Liberty Aces game.
Oh, here we go.
Snapping picks for the world. Were you able to make it to your post-game appearance at iCandy, or did you have to shut that down?
Okay, I don't even know where to start with this.
I saw the flyer. I'm just asking.
What flyer? I don't even know what or where that is. I am doing well live from a Vegas hotel room. I am not on the 50 some odd floor. Sorry to disappoint. It is a solid room. Very cool. Happy to be here with you. Happy to be in Vegas. Excited for Summer League because, of course, I'm excited for Summer League. A lot of young talent in the building. A lot of unheralded talents are going to be in the building. We are recording a little earlier than usual on a Thursday afternoon since I will be skedaddling for the Magic Rockets game. Excited to see Jabari Smith, Paolo Banchero. It's a fun weekend. Going to be a busy weekend. Vegas for a couple of days, up to Chicago for W All-Star. Was able to get the credential. Very blessed and excited to be there as well over the weekend and then back to Vegas. But it's hoop. Love hoop.
Very exciting times and very well deserved. So I'm very happy for you, man. I hope you enjoy this time. I know we got to get you out of here to get you to the influencer tournament. So I'll do my best to keep my thoughts brief. Make sure we get you out of here on time. And we got a hard out today. But, you know, since we got all the pleasantries out of the way.
Ah, here we go.
Talk to me nicely. Talk to me nicely. Talk to me nicely. Proper respect, proper English, good tone. Talk to me nicely. All texts and emails with complete sentences.
Wow.
No emojis, no LMBOs, just talk to me nicely. It's Liberty season. It is Liberty season. Who did they just beat, Nikias?
The New York Liberty did beat the Las Vegas Aces last night.
What's good? Dropped 116, a 40-minute game. Sabrina dropped the first 30-point triple-double in W history. Shot 10 for 13 from the field, 7-8 from three. Hanzu, 24 points in 20 minutes, 11 of 12, and only missed one shot and got her own rebound and scored immediately after.
Yes. Yeah, a sprinkled in jump hook over the outstretched arms of an Aces player that could not do anything with Hanzu in the paint.
Natasha Howard doing it on both ends of the floor, causing all sorts of problems with switchers. Marine passing it all over the place.
Yes.
Give me a handoff and let me shake and see what's going on. Bombing away from three. What's good, Nikias?
What's good was that Liberty offense because they were humming for most of the night. Forget most of the night. They were humming all night long. There was like a patch early second quarter where the Aces were able to get some stops. Their second unit played well. Well, one, their second unit played. Let's applaud there. But two, their second unit played well. And so second quarter, they were able to get back into things and eventually take a small lead. But no, I was in awe of what the Liberty were able to pull off offensively. You already mentioned the stat lines. The way that Sabrina Ionescu dictated terms on offense, just flowing into pull-up threes just about whenever she wanted to, got to the rack. She scored on all three levels. The passing playmaking was there. Not just the first 30-point triple-double in W history. 31, 13, and 10, no turnovers for Sabrina Ionescu in this game. The Aces were searching all night long for a coverage that worked for them. And it was...
If only.
Yeah, if only. You know, if only there was a podcast that discussed the issues with the Aces' defense. I don't know. Anyway, it was interesting to see them say, you know what, we're just going to lean harder into switching. We don't want to put two on the ball. We're not going to allow the same pockets and drop as consistently. Let's just switch, and then we'll see what we can do from there. And the we'll see what we can do from there portion of it just did not go well. continued to not go well. First play of the game was New York running some action, and they get, and because of the Aces switching, they end up with Kelsey Plum defending Natasha Howard. I'm just like, oh no, that's not great. De'Erica Hamby is on Crystal Dangerfield, who started the game but did not start the second half. I don't think she played much, if at all, in the second half because of the play of DeeDee Richards. We'll get into that later. But anyway, De'Erica Hamby's on Crystal Dangerfield. She drops down like, crap, I got to get Kelsey Plum out of here. It's a kick to Crystal Dangerfield for a three. Literal first possession of the game. And I tweet out like, this can't keep happening. And in my mind, I'm just like, oh, this is a problem. If this is how things are starting for the Aces, I'm a little bit worried. Now, even with that, I didn't anticipate the level of shot making that we saw from the Liberty. And even Becky Hammond alluded to it after the game in her opening statement. She was like, sometimes the numbers just don't come up your way. She did get into some of the structural issues that Aces had, but she acknowledged like, yo, like we had some things to fix, but also the Liberty were just shooting the leather off the ball. But the Aces defense is kind of where I land. Like it's, they have no sense of what they're doing right now.
Interesting way to put it. The ironic part is, as I watched that first half, I saw the Aces switching. I felt like the Liberty had some of the best movement they had in a long time. And it just didn't really matter because the Aces switches were dialed in. But then they kind of had those weird breakdowns. Like it felt like a lot of space Sabrina had all game long coming off screens. And I was kind of like, how many of these are y'all going to let her hit? Because at first I was like, who's taking this game more personally, Sabrina or Kelsey Plum? And then Sabrina just kind of never stopped missing. So that kind of answered that question. And the switching was fine, but like the transition defense was weird. Like the Liberty made a lot of shots, but also they had a lot of shots to make. But as you mentioned, once it kind of got into matchup hunting for the Liberty, where now they could just use their post players against the Aces guards in the switching, it got interesting because it's like, okay, now you have Jackie Young and or Kelsey Plum or Chelsea Gray down there trying to battle. And yeah, you've taken something away, but you've opened something else up. And now you end up having to react to that. Like, what's the point in doing all the switching if now those are going to A, turn into post-up points and B, turn into post-ups that you have to double? So mm-hmm. Now Liberty get to ball movement and rotation just organically out just because you're switching. And, yeah. And that it felt like the Aces were just having to scramble and rotate a lot. And I think that's the interesting part with the Aces defense right now. That switching kind of took them out of their base. But yeah, what is the Aces' base? Like, what are they trying to accomplish? How much of this is them cycling through and trying to find things defensively? But also, how much of it is defenses or offenses finding a counter whenever they switch coverages? Hey, you're going to put two on the ball, we have this. You're going to be in a drop, we got the pull-up. If you're going to switch, we're going to play in the post. And now, how do the Aces deal with that part of it? Because, like, versatility versus base is a really fun basketball discussion to have these days. And so you need the scheme versatility to cycle through teams, but it kind of has to be an extension of what you do. At this point, what is it that the Aces do outside of the versatility?
I think that's fair. And that's something that Asia Wilson pointed to post-game. Like, one, she just, I don't want to say unloaded, like, in a negative sense, but she let it be known, like, hey, our current play is unacceptable. I have to be better. We have to be better. One of the things that stood out from what she said was, like, I feel like we've lost our identity, which was interesting to me because just being in a few of the Zoom calls throughout the season, even when the Aces got out to their 13-2 start, people would ask, like, hey, how do you feel about this new offense? What's different from you? What are you seeing? And the common thread before she would even answer that is, I feel like our defense leads to our offense. Once we're able to get stops and run, like, that's when we're at our best. And she has been consistent throughout that, throughout the season, for saying that. Becky Hammond has as well. Jackie Young has said it. Kelsey Plum has said it on down the line. And so for Asia to be like, okay, no, this isn't just a blip. Like, I feel like we've lost our identity. Like, I think that's pointing to, we have lost our base and connectivity on defense. And so I'm kind of at the other point. Like, I'm not sure where to go. Because I do appreciate that they are cycling through different coverages. They're trying to find the answer. And to your point about base versus versatility, it's important for them to be able to do different things. Like, even in the Liberty game, early on, the Liberty were going with a lot of empty corner pick and rolls. The Aces were pretty comfortable dropping against those. In the middle of the floor is where it got kind of iffy. It wasn't just switching. It was switching with an under pretty consistently from what I saw. And that led to a lot of those pull-ups that you saw from Sabrina in the half court, at least. I'm with you in transition. Like, there was just a lot of space. There was a lot of failure to match up early. And you don't let Sabrina Ionescu waltz into three-pointers because she's Sabrina. Why would you do that on purpose? But as far as the base is concerned, I kind of feel, I guess this is where I understand why they want to go with more switching. Because in theory, like, that simplifies things. And one of the things that I mentioned on the earlier pod and concerns their defense, like, I feel like the rotations have just been off for a week and a half, 2 weeks now, which is where I worry about the, you know, the earlier in the season, they were having success putting two to the ball or having Asia at the level, if not a full flown hedge. They were able to pressure the ball, rotate behind that. And now it's like, okay, what do we do? Now it feels like teams are moving the ball well around that. And even if they don't, the rotations are late or they're blown, or you're getting two people rotating to the same place. And it's just another swing. And now it's another open look. The Aces their 3-point defense has gotten progressively worse as the season has gone on because of those rotations. And so I think that's where the come to Jesus moment comes for them defensively. Like, they and Asia allude to this post game during some of the comments that she made. There has to be a level of faith that they have in each other and a level of connectivity they need to have on that end. Because right now, it's a lot of blown coverage right now. It is a lot of scrambling. And against a team like the Liberty that can just light it up in general, you can't afford to have those kind of breakdowns. And when it's the Liberty shooting the way that they shot on Wednesday night, you absolutely can't afford to have those mismatches. Like, the Aces offense, and Becky Hammon alluded to this as well, like, they scored 107 last night. Like, that's an easy dub for them earlier in the season. The fact that it's nearly a double-digit loss right now just speaks to how far the defense has fallen as of late. That's where the shift has to come.
Yeah, and I think it's little things, tweaking little things. Even if you're going to be switch heavy, be smart with the switches, show the nuance, and recognize what's going to happen when you have those switches. Not just the post matchups, but some of your base or your top helpers are going to now be on the perimeter. So now, who's going to help them? How are you going to play out of that? Just having more of a focus there. And, you know, we've always on this podcast talked about the different phases of defense. The Aces are reacting a lot defensively as opposed to anticipating. So it'll be interesting to see, can they kind of lock that in and get one thing down that they bring every single night? That's kind of been the one thing that's been missing for me. Is it ball pressure? Is it help and recover? Because it kind of feels like they're giving up a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. And now as you cycle through things, again, it's not just, hey, we're taking this away. It's, oh, you're doing this. This is open. We're going to do this. So can they kind of take that away as well? And, you know, seems like a good time for the All-Star break. But yeah, the Liberty, man, that was one of those games where the vision was there. You saw it. The movement, the handoffs, the flow. They were just playing. They were playing out of the flow. The dribble handoff actions were incredible. And they got something out of each big. Like, Hanzu is unlocked right now. She just, it's going up. And they all know it. And she's letting it fly.
Made a three last night.
Oh, yeah. With ease, too. Like, didn't even, no hesitation, let it fly. And then you have Natasha Howard being able to pick and pop, punish in the post. Dolson will come in, give you the defense, give you a couple rolls. Like, it just, again, the pieces continue to fit. And if they continue to bring it defensively, at least enough to where they can push on the other end, it can get fun. Now, I think this was more of an up and down affair, which allowed them to continue to stay in that flow. Can they translate that to some of these other games where it's going to be a little tougher? They're in the half court, can't get stops as easily, but the potential's there.
I'm with you. Before we move forward, just want to shoot you a Sabrina question. Like, is there a coverage for her at this point? Because earlier in the year, like you noted, teams are getting comfortable. Like, they're mixing in different looks with her. It's interesting to see how she sorts through those. It feels like as the season has gone on, she's gotten progressively more comfortable, more confident. You send two, she's firing it, or she's stringing it out and then attacking from there. If it's dropped, she knows what to do. And now, again, a 31-point triple-double with no turnovers. Like, at this, like, how many players are playing better than her right now?
It's a short list. But to Sabrina's credit, earlier in the season, it did look like you could just throw defenses at her. And mixing that up would be able to throw her out of rhythm. But she's responded. And little by little, game by game, each coverage you throw at her, she's found a counter for. If nothing else, to at least get you off that. So, hey, you think you want to put two on the ball, I make this play, now you don't want to do it anymore. You think you want to play drop, I hit this shot, now you don't want to do it anymore. And now there's not the same conviction from your defense because she's now just reading what you're doing and reacting and making you pay for it. And that's huge on top of what she's doing scoring-wise. So she is playing at such a high level, and you got to give her credit for evolving in that way because it didn't look like that to start the season. And I do think that the differences in how she's getting the ball, the flow that she's getting the ball with, the movement that she's getting the ball with at times, knowing that she can get off the ball and it'll come back to her, as opposed to Sabrina make a play, I think that also helps her. Now, hey, if I don't have it, I could swing it. Marie might make a play. Crystal Dangerfield might make a play. We might throw it in the post, and it may come back to me. Now you got to defend me again. Those kind of things makes a difference as opposed to, let me make this pick and roll play. Oh, wait, it's not there. I got to make something out of nothing.
All right.
Those plays have kind of gone away.
All right. Fair, fair. While we're on star level point guards in the W, we did get a report from Howard Megdahl of the Next Hoops that the Mercury have been shopping Skylar Diggins Smith. Not what I had on the bingo card this year. There's just been a lot surrounding the Phoenix Mercury this season.
The land of the disagreements, folks.
The land of the disagreements, indeed. I guess for me, like, this is just disappointing. Because again, like, it's been a lot for the Mercury to sift through this year. And like, some of that, I'd argue the most important portion of their weird season is out of their control. Like, Brittany Griner is not home and she needs to be. But beyond that, between the Skylar Diana blow up, the Tina Charles contract divorce, Vanessa Nygaard saying there's going to be a game in Chicago, but there won't be an all-star game without Diana Taurasi, despite the fact that Skylar has been playing MVP caliber ball this season and is an all-star. And now all of that, I feel like it's just kind of come to Skylar saying, okay, I don't really vibe with this. I don't really vibe with the coach. On the outside, looking in, at the very least, it doesn't look like she vibes with the franchise legend who still has a tremendous amount of pull. And the team is losing. And I'm on my prime balling. What is happening? And we also just had like a Hall of Fame addition to the roster, like leave midway through the year because of everything that was going on. And so just, I feel like, so for Skylar, it's like, okay, what is going on here? And for the Mercury, it's like, do we have the infrastructure to deal with this right now? So I guess for my question to you, like, if you're a Mercury front office, like, how do you balance this is weird, this is messy versus, okay, it's not always going to be like this, and let's not overreact because of how bad this season's gone?
I think it's a tough spot to find yourself in because it was built for this. It was built for this roster. And as you mentioned, it's kind of gone away one by one. So you're in a tough spot where, hey, do we need to pivot? Because clearly there are disagreements that are just stacking up around here. And do we need to pivot? Do we need to at least explore what this looks like? That, to me, I don't blame them for looking at that phase. Now, it's very weird considering you had just won 3 games in a row, but you did lose 2 in a row. And Skylar Diggins-Smith is playing well this season. Like, she is the all-star on the team right now. So despite all of that, she's still producing. So it's kind of one of those things where it's like, has it reached the point where we're just not going where we want to go and we just need to go ahead and pivot towards the next point? Or can this blow over? I don't know if it can blow over. Ever since the DT disagreement, it felt like it's kind of just stayed at a certain level.
Yeah. Like, I guess once you get to calling your coach a clown on social media and then not deleting the tweet, at least at last check, not deleting the tweet, and not only not deleting the tweet at last check, but also like liking comments, acknowledging that you were calling your coach a clown is very much like, yeah, I said it. And then what?
Oh, I did not know about the liking of the comments. See, I think the Mercury deleted their portion of the tweet. So it's just a clown emoji with nothing attached to it.
Ah, I see.
If I recall correctly, last time I checked. Now, I thought, as we had talked about it live on the pod, and I'm going to be respectfully messy here real quick, I thought she had a really good out because the statement could be implied, but you could also pivot and say, nah, the whole thing is a clown show because I should have been voted in. Da 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 da.
Yeah.
But if you're telling me the likes are there, nah.
Yeah, that's a little bit different, I would say.
Man, Coach Nygaard did not sign up for this, dog.
She did not. Like, it's... You were just in the finals last year, man. You were in the finals, and you add Tina Charles to a finals roster. How does that turn into all of this? Again, like, the largest portion is out of their control. You can't game plan for the Brittany Griner situation. And by virtue of Brittany not being there, the team's going to be worse. But as far as the this dynamic that we're seeing, and again, like, I am not a Mercury beat writer, so I don't want to overstep in any way. I can only go by reading people that are in the locker room and what I'm seeing for myself. We all saw the Skylar Diana blow up. We all saw the Vanessa Nygaard press conference. We all saw the Skylar tweet. We all heard what Sophie Cunningham yelled the game immediately after Tina Charles. Like, these are all things that we can helicopter in and see and hear. And so I can only imagine, like, what the dynamic actually is in the locker room if these are the things that we're seeing in public. And I'm just like, how did we get here?
I don't know, but of the players currently on the roster, I feel like the only person, if you ask them, did they sign up for this, the answer would be yes. It would be from Sophie Cunningham.
That would track. On the Skylar portion, that's because, okay, the reports are that the Mercury have at least explored trading her. Where would you be trading her and for what? Like, what type of package would you be looking for? Would you be looking for a star-level prospect and stuff to try to turn things around this year? Are you looking for a pick-heavy package to kind of put yourself in the building for next year's draft? Like, what type of, if you have a specific package, that would be cool, but, like, what type of package would you be looking for?
I would assume a pick at this point. If you can get a young player, that'd be great, but I would assume a pick compensation would be ideal. I don't know. Feels weird. Because she's really good.
Yeah. Oh, man, this is just unfortunate. Like, I think I also aim for, like, let's get a young stud in here. Because I do think, in general, the backcourt is going to have to pivot some. Like, there's been no announcement that Diana Taurasi is retiring this year. But I would imagine within the next two, she will. And if you're moving Skylar, like, you're going to want some young talent on the roster. Like, you just added. Also added Diamond to Shields this year. A young wing. Like, still have Breonna Turner up front. She's young. Sophie Cunningham is also young. And so if you're going to move Skylar, like, I think it has to be youth-focused, I believe. Howard Megdahl, in his piece with the report that the Mercury was shopping Skylar, like, he did mention the Los Angeles Sparks, which could serve as an interesting jump-off port. Like, there is Kennedy Carter, depending on what her value is right now. Hasn't cracked the rotation in the way that I thought she would this year. And she has also dealt with some injury stuff this year, which kind of complicates the playing time. But she is still young and talented. If you want to build out a package around that. The Connecticut Sun are also interesting just because they're already missing their starting point guard. Like, could you see a Breonna Jones-based package? Like, that's not a guard, but...
I mean, I could see it. I don't know if I do it if I'm Connecticut, just based on what I got.
Yeah.
How good she is for them, but I could see it.
Yeah, that's where I'm just like, I don't know. Like, that's also the difficulty, because, like, if you're, like, I don't think you're trading, even if you are looking for the youth package. Like, if I'm the Indiana Fever, why am I trading for Skylar Diggins-Smith right now? Obviously, she's very good, but, like, is our team ready for phase two of the rebuild, basically? Again, zoom now. I would love to see Skylar Diggins-Smith and Kelsey Mitchell together. Would be incredibly dynamic. But, like, are they ready for that? And so, like, I feel like it kind of has to come from a contender, like the Sun, or a team in the middle tier that feels like, okay, if we can get one more, if we can make a move that knocks off the glass ceiling, we can maybe do something. Like, that's where the Sparks kind of come in for me, is because it's been inconsistent. They've had a coaching change midway through the year as well. But, like, just from a talent perspective, the Aguma case, you have Jordan Canada, you have Liz Cambage, you have Brittany Sykes. Like, you have a lot And even if you build a package around Kennedy Carter and picks and something or whatever else to get the salary there, you're still going to be left with a lot of talent. And you have half the year to make a playoff push. And we just saw what Chicago Sky did last year. They weren't a top two seed. They were trying to sort through things for most of the year. But once they got into playoffs and jail, the talent shone through. And so I think for the Sparks, that could they I could see them talking themselves into doing that. Also, how would we feel about, this is just putting the Homer hat on. Like, could you build something around like Chelsea Gray and something? If they want more immediate help versus the youth package.
I don't know if the Mercury would go for that. Just with the position they're in. Winning wise. I don't know about that one.
Just want to throw it out there. All right. That is the W coverage for now. Unless you actually, do you have more thoughts before we move on to the free agency portion?
No, we're good right now. I've got my eye on the prize. Looks like the influencers are starting to pile in. So definitely want to make sure I get you taken care of.
You got it. Anyway, just do some housekeeping before we get into the summer league portion. Bradley Beal, I guess July 6th marked the end of the moratorium period, so all the signings became official.
Bagley Beal.
I will let you have that one. That is fine. 5 years, well over $200 million. But the note for me is that Bradley Beal, on top of the max money, gets the 15% trade kicker and also becomes the 10th player in NBA history. Learned something new on Wednesday. Became the 10th player in NBA history to flat out get a no-trade clause in a contract. And the list is basically first ballot top 30 players of all time and Bradley Beal, which is just funny to see on screen. But, like, I don't know. How do you – like, it's a great deal for Bradley Beal, obviously. From the Wizards' perspective, how do you feel about that contract?
Salute to Bradley Beal and his representation for getting that done. I don't necessarily know how to feel about it from the Wizards perspective. I could understand if you are maybe a Wizards fan and you're like, why would y'all do that? Mm-hmm. Now we're kind of locked into whatever Bradley Beal wants. So I would totally get that perspective. For me, it just kind of feels like, I don't want to say they, see, I don't know if I would say they got scared. I just felt like they wanted to take care of their guy and they went ahead and did it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if that's something Bradley Beal wanted and they wanted to keep him around, we've had all these years and years of rumors swirling around Bradley Beal leaving Washington. And he's like, yo, I don't want to deal with that no more. Okay. Like, to me, sometimes it's as simple as that. I guess showing a little bit of a commitment there. It's more of a big W for Bradley Beal to me.
Mm-hmm. But, absolutely.
You know, and anything that changes has to go through him. I mean, I guess if you're the Wizards, you want to show some level of commitment. I mean, if you're going that deep, giving the bag, you're hoping that you're not going to trade them. So, mm-hmm. Like, I could understand if someone in the office was like, you know what, it's not that big a deal, whatever. We've gone this far. We don't need to sign the prenup. We'll be fine.
All right. Basketball, woo! No, but on the Beal front, like, again, it's great for him. And I don't want it to be lost in translation that Bradley Beal is really freaking good. Like, I think the lack of playoff success over the last 3-4 years for the Wizards can overshadow that. But, like, this is one of the best two guards in basketball. He is a dynamic scorer, dynamic driver. The three-point percentage isn't where you would think it would be. And that, I feel like that's mostly because of the difficulty of shots that he takes, not because he can't shoot. We know Bradley Beal can light it up. I do worry. I think this is just my worry with supermaxes in a cap sport, period. And it's less about Bradley Beal and more so what it means. And so to say Bradley Beal is Bradley Beal worth a 5-year, $200+ million deal, like from a talent perspective, absolutely, in my eyes. When the question becomes, is Bradley Beal, I hate to use worth, like worth sounds too, I don't know. I need to find a better word for worth.
Value. I've replaced value. Worth with value. I try and use value because to me, I don't like the idea of worth. It's not my job to judge their worth. And if they work themselves into a position to earn X, then they earned X. Right. You know, that's kind of my deal. I had to work on that as well.
That's 100% worth. Like, I'm not trying to give off that bar. I'm very pro player.
The 68th floor has changed you, sir.
Oh, here you go. Anyway, but when it gets into, okay, this is 35% of the cap. And now we have to build the roster out around you. It becomes difficult because as good as Bradley Beal is top 20-ish to me at his best. And I think, is Bradley Beal very good? Yes. Is Bradley Beal the best player on a title team? I don't know if I can get there. And if you're trying to build a contender around him, the question then becomes, okay, with him locked into this money, how do we get the guy that is Luka good, Bron good, Durant good, Giannis good, whatever. And I think that contract makes it more difficult to do before factoring in, like, is Washington a free agent destination like a Miami, like an LA? Like, no, or at least historically they haven't been. And so I can get the queasiness from like a Wizards fan perspective because of that. And to your earlier point, like, one, again, this is really good for Bradley Beal. Two, like, Bradley Beal has been pretty consistent throughout this entire ordeal over the last 2-3 years. Teams like, well, if the Wizards aren't winning, I wonder if he's going to ask out. And Beal's like, no, I love it here. I'm cool. I want to do the Duncan thing. I want to build this out. Like, I do. Bradley Beal has been incredible for the community in D.C. Has plenty of off-court ventures. Helping children, just helping the community in general. Like, he has immersed himself there. And so 3 years ago, is Beal going to get traded? No, I love it here. 2 years ago, I love it here. Trade deadline coming up. No, I'm good. We got into the contract talks. Like, it's basically, is he taking the 5-year max or is he going to opt in and see where it goes from there? But like, all indications throughout all of this has been Bradley Beal loves Washington. If he has it his way, he wants to build a winner in Washington versus going elsewhere. And so it shouldn't be a surprise that he signed the deal because he wants to be there. And also, that's a heck of a lot of money. I do worry from Washington's perspective because, again, like, I don't think Beal is a top 10 guy. And I don't know what their pathway is to acquiring that type of dude alongside him. And beyond that, if Beal does end up pulling like DeMelo, where he gets the big money, and it's like, actually, I kind of want to go elsewhere. Or at least that was the fear during the New York era. Like, if he does do that, giving him the no trade clause basically means, okay, I want out and I want to go here. And these are the only places that I will go. And now those teams are like, okay, here's our second best thing and some picks. Here's our third plus fifth best things and some picks. Because if you're trading for a guy like Bradley Beal, who is 29, I believe, you're trading for him to be your final piece. And he's going to want to go to a team that's going to be good enough to compete with him. So those teams aren't going to give up their best stuff for Bradley Beal. And like, we are in the middle of the Kevin Durant saga where he has 4 years in the building. He still asked out. So like, that's.
No, I mean, you definitely take a hit. In that perspective, I guess I can't argue or counter that. If I would try, I would guess if I'm Washington and we're in that scenario, we're cooked anyways. So something has gone wrong and our plan is off the base. In this day and age, I don't necessarily know that they could afford to lose Bradley Beal, whether that threat was real or not. Everyone's making moves. So you need to at least have something plus something to try and get to the next part of it. And, you know, you hope. You got Porzingis, you got Beal, you added veterans. You're hoping that maybe you can take a step and see what the next move would be and then go from there. But yeah, if he had just walked or had gotten traded, what's that next era look like for you? You know, I understand the concerns as far as what you've locked in, but what would you be getting anyways? You know, I guess it's my narrow-minded take there.
I wouldn't call it narrow-minded at all. I think the answer is that you would hope that Rui Hachimura becomes the next Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Dunker Spot. We are beans.
Beans. Okay, let's move into some of the other re-signs really quickly. Caleb Martin back to Miami, a 3-year deal worth a little over $20 million. John Carchar getting the contract extension from Memphis, 3 years, $19 million. How do we feel about that one?
Caleb Martin, salute for him getting rewarded. I think that's awesome. He fits in what Miami does, multiple positions, give you a little shooting. They're going to need a little bit more of what he does with PJ Tucker leaving. So good for him to have found a home. I'm always rooting for players to have that experience. Conchar intrigues me, but they like what he's done in the system, and good for him to go from his path, go to the G League, make the team, get an extension from the team. That's not easy. Mm-hmm. Now it's going to be on him to step up. There's going to be more of an opportunity for him. And we saw him playing a lot of minutes last year. Can he take another leap, keep making threes, add the defense, add the playmaking, and help this team grow? But good for Memphis for keeping him in-house. So I like both those moves.
Okay. I'm with you on Caleb. I'm with you on Conchar. Like, I think it's a good deal for him. I guess for me, it's just like, I understand why he re-signed John Conchar, because I think he's good. He's a good basketball player. I just look at what the rest of the roster is for Memphis. I'm just like, okay, do we get to a point in Memphis to where you sign him to that, and then he's your fourth forward because of who else you have, which isn't his fault. Like, the strength for Memphis is they are incredibly deep. But when it comes to, like, these kind of extensions, that's where I'm just like, and I could be wrong. Like, that's just my initial thought. Like, okay, is he going to be in position to make that deal worth it, if that makes sense? Because he could be 3 for 19, good, but if he's playing 10 minutes a game because of who's ahead of him, then what does that mean for Memphis? Like, that's kind of where my mind went.
I understand that. But, I mean, it's not always bad to have someone on a value deal that helps your depth. It doesn't necessarily need to do X, Y, and Z to succeed. I think that's good for them in their back pocket. They know the role he can play in. He'll be happy there. Kind of a win-win in that scenario.
All right, I got you. The Knicks re-signed Jericho Simpson, 3-year deal. I haven't seen the money on that yet, but nice for them to lock him in. After locking in Mitchell Robinson, Kessler Edwards was waived a little bit earlier this week, or they had the team option decline, but he has re-signed with Brooklyn, so no smoke there. While we're on Brooklyn, as we get into some of the signings, TJ Warren and Edmund Sumner going to Brooklyn on minimum deals. Do you like those moves for Brooklyn?
Quick update on Jericho Sims. They said 3 years, just shy of 6.
Okay. Appreciate you, good sir.
Hey, no worries. The Google hands are strong. The question was the Nets offseason. Is that correct?
Yeah, just the TJ Warren flyer and also Edmund Sumner coming off his injury as well.
It's very interesting. You know, if it wasn't for all that.
Yes.
The Nets would be checking a lot of boxes this offseason.
Great show, by the way.
It wouldn't be a bad offseason. All that. That's a good shot. If this is a team that you looked at and you said, hey, they lack wings, they lack size, that hurts their lineup versatility, they went ahead and got some wings and some size. Mm-hmm. Like, losing Bruce Brown isn't ideal, but I mean, of course, we don't know exactly what TJ Warren is, but if he can come back close to what he was, we know what he can do. That's some good scoring. That's to give you some versatility. He can self-create. It's going to put some tough lineups out there if you get it right, and he's got some size. Add Royce O'Neal as well. Sumner is a really good value signing for me. Coming off injury, hope he's healthy, but he's got that burst of athleticism, and he's got the size. He potentially give you some scoring. At least gives you another option with the size, as opposed to, hey, Kessler Edwards, you kind of got to be that guy. So at least you kind of have options there. And it'll be interesting to see how Kessler Edwards performs, having gotten a taste of it, having outperformed where he was at, but also showing flashes of the 3-and-D guy that's needed. But now maybe not having the same opportunity because there's competition. Mm-hmm. But that's going to be an interesting dynamic. I don't think it's going to speak badly on Kessler Edwards, just like I don't think last year spoke badly on him. He just had to do a lot of lifting in that role where it's like, your flashes are great, but we kind of need you to hit these threes. And you can't fall asleep on defense. Like, we need that. It's a little different this year. He might have some more rope, smaller doses, might improve, haven't gotten the reps. But if you're Brooklyn, you at least have options. So if you can somehow take those two to dinner, I mean, one of those to dinner and see what's up. Doesn't sound like it's very likely, but you at least check some boxes off on things you needed going into this offseason.
Hashtag please don't go. I'm with you though.
Nah, do not disturb.
Oh man, shout out to the Haynes report that Kevin Durant has reportedly gone dark with people trying to get in touch with him to see what he's thinking.
You say that?
Thomas Bryant to the Lakers. Woo! Actually, is that a woo?
I like Thomas Bryant to the Lakers. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. The reports were Thomas Bryant is going there to start.
I believe he would be the starting center in this aspect.
That part I'm kind of like, why? I'm not going with the Anthony Davis thing.
We know why.
I have for years let y'all know exactly what the Lakers are trying to do with five, play them the four, and then make the five lineup pop. I'm tired of saying it. Y'all have a blast. Is Thomas Bryant the guy to be the five next to AD? I guess is my question. That's no disrespect. I kind of like Damian Jones just because he could just do this and that, and that's it. Thomas Bryant has the ability to do more. He can be more active in pick and roll, but the drop defense can be a little shaky, and he can space the floor, which could help in theory. Mm-hmm. He can roll, so you can have more spacing for your post-ups. You can still have a roller. So in that idea, that kind of works. But if it doesn't work on the defensive end, was it worth it? That's the only point where I'm like, let's see it first. Like, let's just see it first. Like, I get it. Mm-hmm. Let's see how it works first. But hey, this could be them saying, yeah, we need more space. We need space floor. We want to keep as much versatility. We know what kind of big we need. And let's see if Thomas Bryant can give it to us. So I guess jury's still out. But the Lakers clearly looking for a type and trying to get it on the margins.
I applaud the effort. We talked about their offseason in earlier episodes. Like, I've liked the flyers that they've taken so far. The Thomas Bryant one is interesting because offensively, I definitely get it. The versatility and pick and roll, you already hit on it. The spacing would be the most important aspect of it for the Lakers, just to give the Bron AD pick and roll more room, or the Russ / Kyrie AD pick and roll, whichever guard is there. By the time the regular season starts, we'll see. But that makes sense to me. He's also a pretty good screener just in general, so that should help free the guards. The defense, he made some minor strides the last time we saw him. But it's still so messy. And I just worry.
Respectfully.
It's messy. And so it's like, okay, you know, going into the AD thing, like, all right, cool. We have another big body, so AD doesn't have to defend the bigs. I feel like the energy is just going to be expended as a helper instead of having to bang with the bigs. Because, like, if you're having Thomas Bryant in a drop, good luck. We'll see. Like, he's still young. So, like, there's definitely room for him to make more strides. But I'm also just like, man, I've seen Thomas Bryant on defense. And this is going to be Thomas Bryant on defense coming off of, like, he's still covering and stuff. Like, this has been a long 2-year stretch for him from an injury perspective. And so I just kind of worry about what that's going to look like. You're going to need full-fledged AD. Has the potential to do it. We just need to see it. And then I kind of worry about, okay, what's the rest of the personnel going to look like defensively? Like, which version of LeBron are we getting on defense next year? Because if it was the version that we got for most of last year, I'm a little worried. And if they don't find something for Kyrie and you have Russ and LeBron and Thomas Bryant, even if Anthony Davis ain't banging with fives, I feel like Anthony Davis might still get to a point where it's like, yo, can I have some help, please? And so I think that's where my questions reside right now. Like, I'd want to see how this works defensively. Like, which version of Bryant do we get? Do we get some strides for him in space?
The plus I will say is he did display a higher level of activity. Mm-hmm. And if he can at least embrace that, that should be a plus for the Lakers, if you consider their struggles in drop or in pick and roll at times. So if you can get the activity, if you can navigate and recover, you might have a shot at it. So I'm intrigued. I just wasn't expecting it. B kind of felt like a lot. That is my Lakers talk for the month of July.
All right. Well, then, now to the most important signings of the past few days. The Spurs were able to claim Isaiah Roby off of waivers, and they also signed Gorgui Dieng to a one-year deal to help their big man depth. Steve, your thoughts?
I like the pickup of Roby. Didn't they already do Gorgui once? Didn't they already see this movie? I'm confused.
If at first you don't succeed.
No, don't dust yourself off. It's fine. Sat here for 2 years, this man says Gorgui is the best free agent big available. And you see Andre Drummond went to the Bulls and Gorgui just went on back to the Spurs.
He shot 67% from two as a member of the San Antonio Spurs, which was a career high for Mr. Gorgui.
Good for him. Fair enough.
Wow.
Valiant effort.
Wow.
The other ones.
Wow.
Because I didn't see that 67% in Atlanta.
This is some peak hating, man. That's amazing. No, see, in Atlanta, he shot a little over 42% from three. That's the version that you got from Gorgui. Help swing some games for him late.
Wait a minute. Last time Gorgui signed with the Spurs was midseason and you were talking about how big of a move it was for San Antonio? Isn't that the conversation we had last time? Dunkers, look it up in the archives, please. Now this man is back. There's no pomp and or circumstance.
Look, man, they needed some big man depth, needed a vet in the room. Like, Gorgui's been around.
Man,
obviously likes him. They brought him back. Man,
you torched the Zach Collins signing last year, and you're going to let this fly.
I feel like him and Zach could be a solid pairing off the bench.
All right.
All right. Well, then, since we have peak hating Steve today, let's finish this off with some summer league talk. Again, I am heading to Rockets Magic, so by the time this podcast releases, we will have the first few games of Vegas, the Vegas portion of Summer League starting off. So we'll be reacting to those next week. In the meantime, just how do you view Summer League overall? Like when you were in the league or just now, like how much stock do you put into it? What type of things are you looking for? Like, where do you go?
It's a loaded question for me. And I say this as someone who grew up 1000% falling for the Summer League pump fake and hype all the time. Like, I would tell my dad, this player is about to make a leap, and he would laugh at me every single year. But honestly, it's more fun that way. And like, I totally get the folks that say, hey, don't get too high or too low off Summer League games. Like, I would probably recommend the same thing, but I'm not mad at anyone for being excited. Like, the more the Summer League has gone on, the more interest there's been and the events developed. I mean, I think you can watch every game now. Every team's playing in it. There's an attempt at a championship. Like, it's cool to see, like, fans have fun with it. And, you know, you could fall in love with the player. You could say it doesn't matter. It's kind of a win there. There's just too much opportunity involved for me to get, like, completely thrown away and be like, oh, it doesn't matter. Like, I can make my jokes about the rosters and, like, you having to play certain guys and certain guys are a favor and some guys you might not actually have a spot for in camp. So it's like, .. Why are they there? But like, it's a chance to get a bag somewhere in the world. Like, I think it's easy to forget that portion. It's a look, like, it's an opportunity to get your name out there. And if you're on a staff, like, it's a real opportunity. Like, for me, that was my first chance to really flex my muscles and elevate my role a little bit, even if I was still in the video room for those 2-3 weeks or 3-4 weeks, depending on how many we did. Goodness gracious. Doing Orlando and Vegas back to back, that was an experience. But like, really getting to walk through sets and run parts of practices and trying to help and find my voice as a young wannabe coach, that was good stuff. Like, learning to communicate and having an impact and knowing, oh, wow, I can really do this. Like, there's value in it. And like, look at Max Strus. Like, this can matter. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the reason things happen, but you improve, you build confidence, you build that and take that into camp. Things can happen for you. You can open some minds and doors for yourself. I mean, even last year, look at the on-ball reps that Desmond Main had. Mm-hmm. That helped him. Like, I don't think that was all of it, but hey, that helped them. And then they saw, hey, maybe we can do a little bit more of this, open some things up. It just shouldn't be lost in the shuffle. Like, I enjoy summer league. I think it's fun. Now, it is interesting. Like, what are you going to get from your roster guys in summer league? So we've kind of seen, like, as the years have gone on, we've seen, I don't want to say less participation, but there is kind of a cap. It is a harder cap now. Like, before it was like, now USAID, you come in at least for two games. Are you going to practice? And now you can kind of see some people are like, nah, like, look at the Rockets team. That might be their youth, but also a lot of those guys not playing this year. And then you have the guys that are probably too good to be at summer league, and they're probably play really well for two games. Then we won't see them again. You never know what you're going to get it from roster guys. And you kind of have to keep that in perspective as you're watching it. Like, are they going to be too cool for it and just take a bunch of pull up jumpers and have to take a punch and get embarrassed before they really start to rev things up? And now you see them competing. Mm-hmm. Are they going to play just their two little games and move on? Are they going to come out gunning for the MVP? Literally. Shooting simply for the MVP. Are they going to be asked to play a different role, and how do they respond to that? You know, flex a little more than on the roster. Do a little bit more. Have some more responsibility. How do they take to that? Does it change their game? Is it something they can package and play with the main roster with? Those kind of things. Like, I like to take notes during summer league. Like, for me, it's like building a file. Mm-hmm. And answering a couple questions that might pop up in my head before a game or during a game, and just kind of database stuff. Like, we all know there's circumstantial summer league stuff that's going to make things look good. Like, your scoring guard is going to look good. Your active big is going to look good. Your wing defender against someone who can't handle the ball is going to look good. Like, I joked on Twitter, like, what is everyone's favorite archetype for a summer league player? But that does play a part. But like, questions I ask myself is like, what did you show? What can you do? Is this transferable, or is this only a summer league deal? Mm-hmm. What did this circumstance look like? Did you respond to this challenge? Did you grow over the course of it? Whether it's that game, from game to game, little things. Like, I go too small with little things for games that people say don't matter. But like, hey, good screen navigation. Mm-hmm. Hey, good job reading the defense on that pick and roll, holding them and making the right read. Good footwork coming off a handoff or a screen. Good closeout rotation, like those kind of things. And then do you see those continue to happen? And now, okay, this is something that I think this person does. Mm-hmm. Or this is something I think this person may need to... This is an opportunity, I guess would be the wording I would say. Mm-hmm. Opportunity for growth. Like, a couple players we'll talk about here shortly where it's like, I'm not going to say this is something they can't do. I'm not going to say this is necessarily a weakness, but something I've noticed. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of build on it from there. And then you kind of evaluate from there for me. So okay. There you go.
Thank you for that. If I can ask one more question before we get into specific players. Since you've been on the team side of it, and if you're able to dig into it at all, like, what is the team building process for summer league? Like, how do you balance... These are young guys. Oh, no. But I guess, like, from an opportunity standpoint, maybe not like a free agency for summer league or anything like that, but like in terms of like, okay, here's our year two guy. We want to see if he can handle more on ball reps versus we want to give these guys that hung around the G League or whatever some opportunities. So maybe this can be a steal for us. Like, how do you balance prioritizing your year two guys versus your rookie versus an undrafted guy that may have been on your G League team last year and moved around, whatever?
Well, I mean, that comes with kind of the spacing and the construction of the roster. Hopefully it's not too big to where the decisions are just a little bit easier. So there might be a game or two where X doesn't play, but, you know, hey, you're going to get showcased this next game. Do your thing. As far as the prioritizing goes, you kind of have an idea of who's getting what look, if that makes sense. So you kind of know who needs to at least get the first shot. And then offensively, it's an organic type deal. There's not a ton of complicated sets. So, you know, it's going to be transition run, pick and roll. And hopefully those two things don't counteract. Like, if you have a point guard that can do point guard things and you're trying to get your wings some more on-ball reps, you may just alternate. Mm-hmm. Hey, outlet to him. Let him start off the play or something like that. So it's nothing too crazy. But you do have to be conscious of featuring guys in the right way and putting them in positions to succeed, because ultimately that's the goal. You know, if you have a screener and a roller, it doesn't make much sense to play him with the point guard that just wants to shoot every time, you know, those kind of little things. Or, yeah, we want to get our wings some reps, but we did sign 7 point guards, so maybe we'll have to just get those out of sets or something like that.
Right. All right. Well, thank you, sir, for sharing your expertise on this.
Man, trying to be packed up.
I am not. I'm genuinely curious. Again, like, I am just a guy on Twitter that watches a lot. You've been on the inside, so like, I want to glean some insight if I can. All right. So for the summer league that we've seen so far, we've had the California Classic over the weekend slash early portion of the week. We've also seen some Salt Lake City games as we transition into the Vegas portion, which will be July 7th through the 17th. From the California Classics portion, like, I think we have to talk about what Keegan Murray was able to do. Sacramento's number 4 overall pick this year, averaged a shade under 20 points per game, shot nearly 44% from 3, averaged 8 boards. In terms of like specific skills, like, what did you see Keegan showcase?
See, that's the interesting place. I gave that whole summer league melody, and I'm not sure what any of what he did meant, but there is absolutely something in the bag there. The off-ball movement and the movement shooting definitely caught my eye. I just thought he showed a lot of versatility offensively, just an ability to drive closeouts, not afraid to take and make shots, had a nice level of pace and control. And then you kind of kept watching. It's like, oh, he's coming off pick and roll. Oh, he went right to a pull-up without even thinking about it. Oh, he's posting up smaller guys, and that could be interesting, you know, if he plays the 4 and they're switching. So what I got mainly was he's got something. Now, how they use it, what spot he plays, that's all up to for consideration. So I don't necessarily know if it's going to be an automatic translation, but he's definitely going to help that team. That's the question becomes, you know, can he play the 3? But he's got enough versatility to where I think he can play with multiple players. You can use him different ways, and he'll be able to go relatively quickly from the jump as far as contributing to me.
I echo that. The movement shooting in particular stood out. Like, I was curious to see like how the Kings would use him, because he does already have like the NBA made body for me. And so that's where some of the mid post isolations that we saw, some of the posts against smaller guards, where it's like, okay, like, this dude knows how to use the body, can get to his spots, is not rattled by physicality. And I think that was the big thing for me inside the arc. Defensively, 2-year, can he play the 3 question? Like, I jotted down in my notes in the first game that I watched, he was like, the screen navigation is kind of all over the place right now for Keegan. And so I wonder if they do agree that he's NBA ready and he can start for us and give us 27 minutes already because he's that good, knows what to do on offense. Like, what is the scheme going to be? Like, I would worry about this being like a drop heavy system. One, if Domantas Sabonis is your 5, like, I would worry about drop. Like, does that give them more license to be like, okay, we're going to play Sabonis high just to help Sabonis, but also like Keegan doesn't have to navigate the screen. Like, he just needs to be active, and that helps. Is that a way to kind of insulate him so you can get what you want from him offensively? Because again, like, the shooting is there, it appeared to be, and not just a spot up guy. Like, they were running him through staggered, through curls and pinned. Like, it, the usage was fun. And so my question immediately became, okay, what can they get out of him defensively? Who do they want him to guard? Do they need to be a switchier unit to simplify things for him? And if so, like, what does that do for the rest of the roster?
That's an interesting point. And it's funny because when it felt like he was quote unquote at the 4, he showed a little bit of juice switching onto the guy coming off the screen. I was like, huh, intriguing. So again, what's going to be the best usage for him? And that's one of those things as you watch him play and Vegas, you can kind of see, okay, what does that look like as he continues to play more? What are they trying to have him do? That's one of those things you can track and kind of put some things in the bucket. But yeah, it's kind of one of those thumbs up. Let me see more.
With you. Another guy that shined was, or someone that caught my eye at the very least, we're going with draft picks, Heat forward, or first time forward, I suppose, since he was mostly a ball handler overseas, Nikola Jovic. Not to be confused with the MVP. I hope we're not still making that joke at this point of the portion of the program, but averaged a little bit over 11 points, shot nearly 43% from 3 on almost 5 attempts. I am intrigued by the I guess just the aggression, the confidence that he has offensively. Like, the first game was not great for him. And he immediately improved. Like, the shot started falling, which helps. But you saw him get a little bit more comfortable. The ball swung to him. Okay, let me try to attack off the bounce. Let me try to set up a post up. The screening was hit or miss for me, but he at least looked comfortable trying to make short roll reads when they were there. Some of the passes went haywire, but you could see him mapping out the floor. So that intrigued me. Defensively, again, is kind of where I keyed in. But I do think he projects as a four for Miami. And in the first game, like, I had to kind of remind myself, okay, this is literally his first game. This is literally his first half of action. The off-ball activity just didn't seem great at all for Jovic. And so I wonder what the learning curve for him defensively is going to be. Because I think offensively, it would be pretty easy for Miami to slot him in as a movement shooter. He was also a guy that was comfortable roaming around the perimeter and knocking down shots. And has enough of a handle to be able to self-create. We saw him get some pull-up or step-back attempts from three during the summer league run. We did see him try to tack off the bounce. Wasn't always great. Like, there is a level of physicality that he struggles with right now on either end of the floor. But I think Miami has a fun prospect on their hand. Like, for him to be basically a seven-footer who can handle and shoot the way that he can on a multitude of platforms, like, that's something to build off of.
No, yeah, I agree with Jovic. I think if he has the ability to take and make some of those threes he hit against, I think the Warriors, that's a pretty good base. And that's going to give him an opportunity. I think he's going to a great place to develop and get better and make that adjustment. Because my guy Cooper Marhead had a really good point that helped me put this summer league into perspective. Like, he was showcased in a way and had a lot of responsibilities and versatility that opened up a door for him that he may not be walking through in Miami, at least not right away. So if you were looking for the dribble drives and the passing, the playmaking, probably didn't see a lot of that or felt like he can't really do that. Once he kind of got into the position where he was more of a quote unquote big, you saw more of a comfort. Now, he was still adjusting to it, but you could kind of see more of the base of the outline of, oh, he can do this. Spacing the floor, picking and popping. It's still going to be a process for him. And I'd like to see him kind of lock in that base and then grow from there. Just little things as it went on, like knowing when to take and make those threes is big. He got more aggressive as he got into it, but there's still some pump faking air at times. But to your point, I liked his mindset on the drives. He's clearly not afraid. He likes to compete, shows some juice driving. Defensively, there was at least an effort made to competing a couple times, rotating a couple times, trying to contain drives, which to me is half the battle. You know, positioning is going to be a battle, but you got to at least have the mindset to give yourself up for it. So to me, it's how much he adjusts around the shooting. And what does he build on past that? That's going to be interesting because the post-ups didn't really move people, but then he kind of shot the Dirk fadeaway and was like, interesting. Yeah. So it's kind of like there's something there. He's just got to kind of have to figure out what they're looking for, how to build on it. And it's going to take some time, but I liked what I saw. It was fun.
I got you. While we're on the Heat, just want to give a quick shout out to Haywood Highsmith, who led the California Classic portion in rebounds. Not something that I had on the bingo card. Shot well from three, shade under 42% on four attempts per game during that short stretch. I think these were important minutes for him, especially in light of PJ Tucker leaving. The Heat haven't made a move for a four yet, depending on how they feel about Jovic's readiness. Like, maybe not as a starter, but maybe he gets some of those minutes in year one. Caleb Martin did play some four for Miami in smaller units last year. Like, maybe he slots into that if the Heat don't make a move. Haywood Highsmith is kind of like the wild card of all of this, who we've seen Miami go with the 18-minute energy guy starter before. And with him shooting as well as he did, like, we know the energy offensively and just crashing off of the glass is going to be there. If he can shoot well enough, like, it wouldn't shock me if this plus a strong preseason puts him in the discussion at the very least. Like, let's start him around Bam.
I mean, I think he's going to have an opportunity. They clearly like him. If he can show an ability to knock down threes, keep playing defense, I wouldn't be surprised if he makes a run. You know, I had a KZ joke, but I'm gonna skip it for time purposes.
Ah, I see. I was just gonna say, like, this is giving me Rodney Magruder vibes a little bit. Just especially this summer league opportunity he's getting so far. We'll see what the usage is gonna be like in Vegas. But he's been interesting. Quick Laker shout out, since you are done with Laker discussion for the month, or at least until Kyrie gets traded, we'll see. Jay Huff gave us a fun couple of games, basically 10 and 7, had 5 blocks across his 2 games, shot 40% from 3. I was not expecting to see the blend of 3-point shooting and also dunking on people and also swatting shots. Like, if he gets more burn during Vegas, like, I would imagine some team is going to look at him as like a fourth big somewhere. Like, hey, let's stash him. Because the energy was there. The shot was there. That he showed some stuff.
Jay Huff is giving summer league favorite vibes. And that's going to be especially important if he does the blend of 3-point shooting and dunking in Vegas in a Laker uniform, considering how Vegas treats the Laker summer league team. Mm-hmm. The roar that would get.
Yes. He would slap right in.
Also, I wanted to salute Max Christie real quick. I like his juice defensively. He really works to get into your body off the ball, works to navigate screens, slides to stay in front. Just a good awareness and mindness from him. Like, it's not bad when you bring the defense part of the 3-and-D to the table first. So I did want to salute him. I'm going to keep an eye on see how that continues to grow, but some would say he's got that dog in him.
There we go. Before we move to the Salt Lake City version of this, what did you make of the Moses Moody on-ball reps for Golden State?
Moses Moody.
That's the one.
He looked like a guy who was looking to score. And if it wasn't there, he's going to pass. But just looked like a guy, hey, I'm not going to play too many of these, so let me get him up and see what's going to happen. Those are the ones where I'm just like, I don't judge you. Like, hey, if that's how you're going to invest in it, go get some buckets, man.
I respect it. Okay, Salt Lake City. I think we kind of have to start with the Thunder. Just one, the pure volume of prospects that they had. Like, I feel like they had very important pieces of their rotation.
Man, they had their whole roster out there, Doug.
So we kind of have to start with the Thunder. I will open this up to you. Do you want to start with Chet? Do you want to start with Josh Giddey? Where do you want to go first with the Thunder? Who called you?
Let's get Giddey first. I know you are giddy about those passes, so let's go ahead and talk about him real quick.
He's so fun. Like, Josh Giddey is pretty much on the cusp of being too good for summer league. Like, I am not a Thunder beat writer, so I don't know. My guess is that he plays 1, maybe 2 in Vegas and then shuts it down. But once I saw that he was on the roster, my thing was like, okay, what are the scoring reps going to look like? We know he can make every pass in the book. Is there going to be a focus on getting in the paint? What is the jumper going to look like? To the jumper portion, I appreciate a little bit more comfort shown to him pulling up from 2. Like, I think that's going to be important for him, especially if teams continue to go under. Like, if he can work himself with some lower pick and rolls and get around the elbow or so. Like, he has good enough touch to knock those down. We talked about his floaters a little bit during the rookie reports last season. The 3-point shot just did not fall, and that's going to remain problematic if he can't knock those down. But with him on the ball, especially in that first game against Utah, I noted it on my timeline. We have some clips. Like, it looks like he's working on the foul draw. Like, he's trying to sense when the defender's coming. He's leaning the shoulder into him, hopping off, drawing contact that way. There seemed to be a real point of emphasis for him to get downhill. He did not always get foul calls. He did not always finish through contact. Again, recording early on a Thursday, so if you saw that game or hung in the watch party with us, you did see the poster dunk that he had, which was wow. But in general, he went head hunting in the paint, and he needs to be able to do that. Because one of the things that I talked about last season was he would get a high pick and roll, and even if it wasn't an under, he'd get around the elbow, and he's picking up his dribble. And I'm just like, no. Like, it's good that you can make these early skips to the corner. The passing is very valuable. But in order for you to really become a high-level secondary option, because we know as long as Shea's on the team, he's going to be your number one. But for Giddey to turn into that number two, like, the scoring has to come from somewhere other than the floaters. He has to generate deeper paint touches and do that more consistently. So it was good to see him putting that focus in and trying to get down.
No, I like that aggression as well. This is one of those moments watching Giddey. I don't think you're going to get a ton out of it because of the question marks that we got from the regular season. I don't know if you're going to get those answers here, but it was good to see him be aggressive when turning the corner and not really be timid. And anytime they kind of put two on the ball or fight over the screen, he's been able to make whatever read he wants to, which is a positive sign. The thing for me, and the passing has been ridiculous. Thing for me is, how does he deal with unders and how does he deal with switches and what does that look like? Is he going to be comfortable getting to the jumper from there? Does he feel comfortable getting those reps off here? Swing it to him on the perimeter. Does he look for his attack? Does he try and get to a pull up? But just those little things. Are we going to see the confidence there? Are we going to see some reps there to where maybe we get some off ball answers? But passes and vibes and aggression, it's going to equal success for Josh Giddey in summer league. There's no doubt about that.
Can't go wrong with that. Now let's move to Chet Holmgren. Basically, every 17-10 in his couple of games. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, man. Lead off.
Oh boy, I can already see that Chet is going to be the most polarizing prospect from this class. I have not seen Jabari Apollo yet, but we've seen Keegan Murray. We're going to see some of the other lottery picks in Vegas. Chet's going to be the polarizing one. Just watching the timeline from his first game to his second game to where Chet was incredible in the summer league debut. I think 23.7 boards, 6 blocks, 4 assists, 4 of 6 from 3, I want to say. And of those threes that he took, this dude is dribbling up behind the back dribble to stop and pop and pull in someone's face. I'm just like, wait a minute. This is insane. Second game, if it wasn't the first possession, it was one of the early possessions. Kenny Lofton Jr. just put him underneath the basket. And
oh, no, it was the first, second, third.
You know, he kept putting him underneath the basket. And I remember, quote, because you posted a video of that, the first Kenny Lofton drive, and I quote tweeted it with Woo. And like 2 minutes later, I was like, let me check back in on this. I looked at the quote tweets of that tweet. I was like, wow, the pure volume, I already know what this is going to be. And it was the same. He's going to be broken in half. He's going to be a bust. Well, he isn't a Hall of Famer now, is he? Kind of parroting the excitement that people had for him in the first game.
Let's learn our lesson, folks. Let's not make this a tennis match already. Chet Holmgren, like, this does not need to turn into Rudy Gobert, Carmelo Anthony talk already. He's played 2 summer league games. He has shown good things in both of them. He has shown some things to work on in both of them. There's plenty of game to speak for itself. Like, we don't have to do this. It does not have to be this way. Like, it does not have to be this. Like, it's so much like one thought process against the other. And it's like, there's such a middle ground here that we could just talk about. Mm-hmm. That's why I've tried to be like just super careful with the wording on any clip I put with Chet Holmgren involved.
It's just gonna be this.
It shouldn't be.
It shouldn't. I 100% agree with you. It should not be. I think there is room to recognize, hey, stronger dudes may be able to move him, and also acknowledge, hey, his length and his timing as a rim protector are going to be positives for him.
Like, yeah, it doesn't help when people like you say he had the greatest summer league performance half history ever.
That is not what I said. Don't put that evil on me, Ricky Bobby. I said Chet Holmgren with one of the most impressive halves in summer league history.
I was just firing you up for content purposes.
I appreciate it. But like, even with that, like, I do think that first half of the debut was insane. I also watched that full game against Memphis earlier, and I said, okay, if he's getting moved by Kenneth Lofton, like, that can be a problem. Like, to his credit, like, he did still try to contest some of the shots after being moved, and you can see where the length can make some of those finishes tougher. But even then, like, it's fair to acknowledge, okay, this is some high-level stuff, and also, hey, this is a problem area, and, like, let's just acknowledge both. I'm with you.
No, I mean, the one thing with Holmgren that you mentioned it is the paint presence on defense. Like, the drives from guards have not had the same zip when he's patrolling the paint. Like, his roaming rim protection has been good. Like, do these contests turn into fouls once the season comes in? We'll see. we see how guards drive at Rudy, so I imagine they'll drive at Chet Holmgren. We'll see how he holds up. But the instincts and drop have been good. I haven't had much of a concern. He's got good size, good length. He's backpedaling, containing the drive. It's good stuff. He works to contain penetration, which is important. He always works to contest, which is important. We know about the threes. The thing offensively for me, like, I like OKC letting him push the ball up. And he does have a lot of those I'm taller than you shots, which there's not much you can do. Mm-hmm. If I had to say something I'm keeping an eye on, screening.
Yes.
He's got some Evan Mobley in him, all due respect.
Yes.
And then the driving windows and the driving lanes. Like, I like the idea of him driving. When is he going to drive? And what is he driving into? And what is that creating? Like, when Memphis started to really sell out on his pop in that second game, is he going to drive there? Is it going to turn into help? Is that going to be a kick? Or is that going to be a drive behind the back, a turnover? Because I think you got to realize, hey, man, you're real tall. And we're looking at you driving the ball. So I'm going to try and come take it. So we'll see. As far as the strength thing goes, he's going to live with that for a little bit. He's going to have to respond to people delivering that first blow. Because Kenny Lofton Jr. was putting him under the basket and finishing and kept hitting him. But to Chet's credit, he was fighting, working to contest. Second half, he got lower, tried to do his work early. He's going to have to do his work early. Mm-hmm. Can't let him get the spot they want. Can't let him hit you first, bump you all the way back. You have to absorb a couple more blows. And let's see how it works. But it's a good basketball player.
Jalen Williams is also a good basketball player. Do you want to sing the praises of Jalen Williams?
Man, I came on this podcast. The only thing I have for the draft episode was my favorite player is Jalen Williams. And everyone thought I was talking about Ian, but I was talking about Ian. And then this man, Nikias, shamelessly says he's buying all the Jalen Williams stock. And he's at the household of Duncan's. What'd you say? The Duncan, the nation of Duncan domination. I don't know what you said.
Wow.
Now you're trying to say that you stand both of them. And I'm like, wait a minute.
What do you mean? I brought up the other Jalen. Bring up Ian on the pod. I brought up Ian on the pod.
I did. So before you do the new words alert and get all the quote tweets for Jalen Williams piece in about 27 hours or 48 hours. So I get that out there real quick. He just looks confident and poised. Looks like a basketball player. Good vision, good attacks, good drives, like the shooting. Just seems pro ready. Like, seems like you throw him out there, he can give you 5-6 minutes right off the bat. The defensive juice really jumped off the page to me. Like, I wasn't expecting that as much. Really good screen navigation at times, physical off ball, working to deny, good instincts off ball as well. So I liked seeing that. Like, seeing the mindset is important to me. Like, okay, he wants to play defense. And that's something that can help earn you minutes. Combined with what he can do offensively. Now, I am curious what it looks like for him versus switches versus unders. Because part of why I liked him was he can make so many plays out of pick and roll. But if they're switching and going under, kind of puts him in a little bit of a box. So we'll see how he develops there. But fun stuff from him, man. He's fun to watch.
Yeah, the screen navigation pop-up screen for me with him. Because I was going into it looking forward to pick and roll reps. And he did have some nice ones. Also, the activity off ball, like having Josh Giddey find him, having Chet Holmgren find him with some high post stuff. Like, he's active and energetic off the ball as well. So I think he'll be able to find points either way. The jumper is going to be a point of contention. Not that he's a bad shooter, but you mentioned like he did see some unders and some switches. And while he does have a solid handle package, like, he's not the burstiest of forwards. He had some really good finishes in the summer league debut. But he does need a little bit of a runway. Like, I don't know if he's good enough to consistently, especially once we get into like the preseason slash regular season portion of the program. Like, I don't know if he has enough in day one to like shift average to above average defenders one-on-one and then get downhill to show off what the finishing package is. So I just want to see where it develops from there. Did you have Ian thoughts before we move off the Thunder?
Oklahoma City's really trying to make small fives a thing, I guess. Uh-huh. I didn't know that they would try and make him Jeremiah Robinson Earl as well. Seems to try and take a lot of charges.
Boy, does he.
That's all I had.
No, that's fair. The Chargers thing, like, underwhelmed as a finisher for me. And, like, maybe that's just the MO for people that watched them more in college. Again, I'm not a draft Nick. But I was expecting a little bit more as a guy that cleaned the glass or just a pick-and-roll finisher. Like, there were some bunnies blown. I was like, okay, got to watch this. Because the energy defensively is cool. But you do have to put the ball in the basket in some way. And so that'll be something I'll keep an eye on as well. Because, I mean, Chet's going to log some minutes in the front court. And we'll see how the rest of the front court shakes out. But if he wants to earn consistent playing time, like, he has to be able to finish. To the Memphis portion, you mentioned Kenny Lofton Jr. How'd you feel about Zaire Williams' first game?
Very early on in that first game, I totally got the vibes that this is going to be a, hey, get these on-ball reps real quick type of summer league for Zaire Williams, which isn't bad. And I totally get why they would do it. Why not invest in that? See what that turns out to. You already like what he does as a player. You know what he can bring to the table. You don't necessarily need him to do more of that. Let's see if we can try and get him something else to see if it'll help us. Give him that responsibility and try and bring that to like a tighter package, you know, on the main roster where, hey, maybe we can run some more handoffs for you, some pick and roll steps like that. Now, what's interesting is some guys, you see them flourish when they're given this opportunity. Some guys, you see them try and force the plays they think they should be making instead of just making the plays they are naturally do. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the experiment because mentally, guys have to remember, you're being asked to do this because your skill set has made this seem like a good idea. Like this is being done for a reason. But as a player, it's a little bit different when you feel like you have to do X, Y, and Z. Like when you feel like you have to set up the table instead of making a play just because the play is there. So he had a couple growing pain moments in that first game. Just little things like knowing when to use the screen, setting up the screen, when to reject, why you're rejecting, what to do when they jump you and put two on the ball. But that's why you give them the reps. So hopefully, you know, pat them on the butt, tell them settle down and just focus in on making plays. I think he played in this third game. I'm just going to box score hunt. 15 points, one assist, two turnovers. So wonder what that looks like.
We shall see. We shall see. Just to close it out as the Vegas
Kenneth Lofton Jr.
All right. I think that says it all. I take it you enjoy the Kenny Lofton Jr. experience.
Boy, he's really fun really summer league guy, man. Like it's the lineup with him and David Roddy got me locked into their first game, and just I wanted them to run everything out of elbow. Like, it was like just watching, hey, run both your running backs. Like, nah, just let them do stuff. And, like, he showed off some passing ability, showing off the three ball, the pop, pump fake, couple dribbles, hit you with a spin, fade away. Like, so, like, someone said they really spawned Z-Bo, and I laughed for a good 10 minutes. Because, man, he's just a bucket, like, given however you wanted it. A bucket. Like, that is a summer league favorite right there. Defensively, got to work on the whole positioning aspect. But outside of that, he has been fun to watch. That's all I got.
No, I think that nails they called, it.
So, shout out to whoever called him Heft Curry.
Oh, that's a good shot. Holy crap.
I got to find who did that on Twitter. I can't remember your name off the top of my head. I'm sorry. But Hef Curry also had me laughing for a second.
Oh, no. I was just going to point out the drives were fun. Like, we saw him against Chet, but, like, he didn't just do it against Chet. So that's fun. Like, I think the defense ultimately is what keeps him from being, like, a roster guy right now. But it wouldn't surprise me if someone takes a two-way flyer on him. Like, hey. Let's get you on the two-way. We'll send you down to G League. We'll try to work out some kinks. If it's going to be a more of a switching defense or whatever the case may be. Or he's got enough juice offensively where you got to at least think about it. He's also just weird. Because, like, I think about this, like, how many second unit forwards are going to be able to deal with that kind of blend of strength and finishing? Not that you build a bench around him, but, like, just in spurts, like, that's fun. And so I think he has enough there to where a team's going to think about it. Before we close it out, anyone else? Well, I guess for the Vegas portion, which teams are you looking forward to seeing? What players are you looking forward to seeing?
All of them.
Okay.
I can't wait for Luka Garza to just make this revenge game.
Oh, absolutely.
In Summer League. And just take all the fun y'all were trying to have. Who are you looking forward to seeing?
Oh, goodness. I want to see the Rockets, period. I also want to see the Pistons, period. I'm very excited for the second game of the doubleheader to kick off the Vegas portion. Finally get to watch Shaedon Sharpe play basketball. Like, we just haven't been able to see that. I know I haven't. Like, I don't scout. So, like, I haven't seen. I wasn't in the building for, like, the high school games or whatever. So I just want to see if the shot making is real, if the athleticism is real. Beyond that, more Jovic minutes just to see how that develops. I want to see the Charlotte contingent because they need one of their young guys to pop. Like, do we see James Bouknight get to do things? That would be cool. What does year two of Kai Jones look like? Charlotte could use that blend of rolling and freakish athleticism. And so that's kind of where the eyes go off the top of my head. Oh, Jaden Hardy in Dallas. Let's see if the on-ball reps are real. They may need a little bit more creation off their bench. They have not replaced Jalen Brunson yet. So does he show enough to where Jason Kidd's like, he could work as an eighth man in year one. Let's see it. Those are the specific ones off the top of my head, but I'm ultimately with you. Like, I just want to see all of it. I am a Summer League sicko, so I'll be bouncing around. I'll be in Thomas Mack. I'll be in talks.
I'll be signing autographs, folks. You got to get them in while they're cheap first, man.
Hard disagree. I'm not going to be signing autographs, man. Let me watch.
He'll be in the plaza between Thomas and Mack and the Cox Pavilion.
See, also, this I know your big time because I don't even know what that
be in the plaza in between, and then he'll also be at section 122, I believe, tomorrow from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. So look out for that, folks.
That is insane. Thank you for listening to this episode of the
Dunkers. You know what's insane? The offensive ratings of Rudy Gobert and Karl-Anthony Towns. And
offensive rating should not be used as an individual stat.
I don't care if you're using the
basketball reference version of the stat. That's not how that's supposed to work. It's not how it's supposed to work. That's not it. Steve is celebrating because he got me big man before I hopped out of here. I am about to sign off and call my Uber to get to Thomas and Mack so I can watch Rockets Magic. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us. You can find me on Twitter at NikaisNBA. I will not be signing autographs. I am not nearly important enough for that. You can find Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20 because he did not want to come to Vegas with me and hang out, but that's cool though. With that, we will catch y'all sometime next week with some really fun stuff. Keep your eyes peeled.
What a great play I just ran to end this podcast.